welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFTFM. I'm Dana Hill, and I'm the host of the program. My guest today from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine is Dr. Brian DeGangi. Today we're going to be talking about the advantages of mobile technology in shelter medicine. Now that sounds complicated, but once the show gets underway, I think it'll become clear to both you and me. We're going to talk about a new mobile program that exists to help make adoptions go smoother. Animal Airwaves Live is back after this news from NPR. Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFTFM, our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, and today is the 30th of July, and I'm so glad to welcome to the program, back to the program today from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Brian DeGangi. Our topic today, advantages of mobile technology in shelter medicine. Now, that sounds a little bit complicated, and I'll be honest, I don't know all the ins and outs of it myself, but over the next hour or so, we're going to learn all about it. Of course, we all recognize that shelter medicine is a really important arena of veterinary medicine, and one that makes a big difference to our communities and, of course, to the animals that are in our communities. So let me first say welcome back to the program, Dr. Ganji. I'm really glad to have you here.
Thanks, Dana. It's a pleasure to be back here.
I wonder, and I don't mean to put you on the spot with a question like this, but can we talk about sort of the scope of shelter medicine as kind of a specialty throughout the country in terms of, how many veterinarians do you think there are in the country that study shelter medicine or focus on that? Is it kind of a niche area, or is it becoming more common that vets work on this?
That's a great question. It's actually a little of both. So there are a number of practitioners who have been studying shelter medicine for years, probably about 20 years now. We've had some veterinarians that really just focused on working in shelters and with shelter animals. And it's been about the last 10 years or so that some of these veterinarians have really tried to get together and solidify what this specialty is and what makes it distinct from other types of practice. And so we're now in the last maybe 5 years or so, we're actually seeing students coming into veterinary school with the thought in mind that they're going to specialize in shelter medicine from the time that they come in. So it's kind of a journey that we've been on, and we're just starting to see some real focus on it as a specific career path.
And for you, what do you feel like is encompassed by the term shelter medicine?
Yeah, it's quite broad, actually. Certainly, we spend a lot of time focusing on physical health of the animals. So the things that you might expect a veterinarian to do, making sure that they're healthy, no signs of infectious disease or long-term illness. But we also focus on behavioral health care in shelters. That's something that we see a lot of. Many of the animals that end up in shelters are there because of a behavioral issue that they had in their previous home. And we're also seeing the animals develop behavior problems when they stay in the shelter for long periods of time. So that's something that we spend a lot of time on as well. We also focus on animal cruelty, abuse, and neglect, and investigating those issues. Spay-neuter is a huge component of shelter medicine as well. So it really encompasses a wide range of fields.
And this is such an important topic because, as everyone knows, pretty much every community in the country has issues with stray and feral animals, has issues with animal overpopulation, pet overpopulation, and a community wouldn't do very well to just ignore this problem or try to sweep it under the rug. I mean, it's something that just has to get addressed because it becomes really problematic if you don't, even discounting the fact that it's just the humane and caring thing to do. Animals left kind of without kind of control could be a nuisance for the community, could really put a strain on other resources. So many communities have animal shelters and services. Of course, in Alachua County, we have not only our municipal Alachua County Animal Services, but we have a number of different organizations that work to either put animals up for adoption or to foster animals. So there's a lot. We're fortunate here in Alachua County, especially, that we have these resources available to us. When we talk about shelter medicine as a specialty, around the country, is it becoming a more common thing? Is it becoming more a bigger area of focus, or is it sort of a regional thing?
It's actually widespread around the country. And so the types of shelters and animals and problems that we deal with as shelter veterinarians tend to vary around the country. For example, in the Southeast, we still have a large amount of pet overpopulation. So we see puppies and kittens in the shelter all the time. If you travel up in the Northeast, there's a lot more spay-neuter resources available, and so we don't see quite as many puppies and kittens. They see older animals. They see animals that are staying in the shelter longer with more chronic diseases that need to be managed. So it's all throughout the country. I have colleagues, you know, all the way in California and Oregon, and all the way up in New York as well. So just widespread everywhere. But I think the different things that we see are slightly different, and that kind of directs how we focus our own studies.
I'm not trying to age myself or anyone else here, but I will say that I recall a time within my lifespan in which there was the dog catcher, right, that would come around looking for dogs if someone complained about it, I guess. And there was the dog pound, you know, and maybe if you were lucky, your community had an ASPCA or something like that. But for the most part, gosh, I feel like at least where I was living, there wasn't a huge focus on really health as much as it was like, we need to just collect these animals and make sure that they're not on the street bothering people.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's how animal sheltering started, you know, over 100 years ago. It was primarily to collect stray dogs and to prevent rabies from being transmitted to people by rounding up the stray dogs. And so we've gradually, in most parts of the country, we've shifted from that sort of reactive state of animal control to a more proactive state where we're trying to push adoption programs and have spay-neuter programs available and kind of prevent the root of the problem from developing. So we've seen a spectrum of shelter types and shelter functions over the years as well.
This is an outstanding shift in kind of focus and goals. And with that shift, can you describe kind of what the best case outcomes for this shift would be?
Yeah, I think what we're seeing is, and what we hope to see as we move even further into the future, is fewer and fewer puppies and kittens born without homes, you know, unintentional litters outside of a breeder that's managing that population. And we're trying to see animals that stay in their homes so that there's resources if people have an issue with their pet that may have prevented them from keeping it years ago. Maybe we have resources that can help them solve that issue today so they can stay in the home. And so, you know, I see the role of shelters in society as shifting towards keeping pets in home, in the homes that they're in, preventing pet overpopulation to begin with, just as a center for resources for pet-owning public.
Mm-hmm. We live in a county where there is a large university and there's another college. There are, you know, tens of thousands of students who live in the community. And one thing that I've wondered over the years is whether our local shelters here are overtaxed by maybe otherwise well-meaning students who decided to, you know, adopt an animal or take in a pet and whose situations have changed and they're suddenly unable to continue caring for the pet.
Right. I think that's a common sentiment that we hear, especially in university towns. And there may be a small amount of truth to that, but I think what we've seen over the long term is that the students are actually more of an asset than a problem. Some of our best foster homes are students, and it's actually a benefit that they're a temporary situation because a foster home is by nature a temporary situation. So they make great foster homes. They're very active in the community. They often will help find adoptions for the animals themselves because they're invested in the outcome. And so it's this great pool of resources that we have, albeit seasonal, But they've been a great help, in at least in our community. And some of the studies that have been done on a more widespread level showed that the same thing, that it's really not as much of an issue as it might seem. We, of course, always remember one or two instances where something like that happened and a student wasn't able to adopt or keep an animal that they had committed to. But if we look at the whole picture, it's actually more of a benefit.
I'm so glad to hear that. And I can also imagine a scenario in which students move into town, they eventually move out of the dorms, they have their own places, they decide to adopt a pet, and then when they go on to live somewhere else and begin their careers, they take their pet with them, and then they've got a lifelong companion, and it's kind of a win-win for everybody involved. I wonder if we can take one more little diversion before we move on to the mobile technology aspect of this discussion. And talk about something you mentioned right at the top of the show related to behavioral issues. Now, everyone who's been to the animal shelter will see animals that appear frightened. Maybe because they're frightened, they behave differently than they otherwise might. I've sort of considered, based on my own experience, that a shelter is probably not the best place to really judge the personality of an animal, because from my own experience, my pet now, who's just a wonderful, wonderful animal, my cat Moggy, she at the shelter, at least to me, didn't seem to be especially gregarious or interested in spending time with me or anything that would suggest that this is going to be the most loving cat. But it turns out she is. And when we brought her home, her personality really emerged. And I wondered if it was because in the shelter, she was around a lot of other animals. And, you know, if any animal that's with other animals, you know, takes on a little bit of a different kind of behavior pattern.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. It's no matter how nice the shelter is, it's an unnatural environment for these domesticated animals to live in long term. And so we see this both dogs and cats, but I would guess even more so with cats, that their behavior and personality is very much dependent on their environment. So just like the cat, your cat that you described, completely different at home than he was in the shelter. And I think a lot of us see that in our own cats in particular. If we take them to the veterinarian, they may not be able to be handled easily, or they may get stressed out in car trips and that sort of thing, but they're the most loving animal at home. So we see that to some degree with dogs as well, but it's very prominent in cats. And so it's definitely a challenge to try to understand the personality of these animals when they're in the shelter, when we're trying to figure out what's going to be the best adoptive home for them after they leave the shelter. You know, shelters, we encourage shelters to try to learn as much as they can about the animal and to be as objective as they can with what they're seeing, and not to really project too much information and read too much into it, because their personalities can adapt based on the environment that they're in.
Listeners of this show from way back might recall a guest I've had on the show before. He was a psychologist, and he studied animals specifically, and he and a grad student of his had kind of been working on an initiative to see what could be done to change the behavior of dogs specifically in a shelter environment, because he had surmised that people going to a shelter to potentially adopt an animal really give very little time to any particular animal to decide yes or no whether this could potentially be a suitable pet. And that dogs that stayed sort of in the back of the kennel and kind of cowered, like sort of afraid, or dogs that were right up at the front that were barking and somewhat, you know, if not menacing, at least kind of hyperactive, those dogs didn't do as well as dogs that kind of were able to, you know, be up at the front, look interested, but not necessarily overeager. And so it occurred to him, well, that perhaps, you know, something could be done to encourage the dogs to behave in the right way, and that might help increase the dog's chances for being adopted. It seemed like a brilliant thought and a great strategy to take, though I wondered whether or not that would maybe hide some other issues that an animal might have deeper down. That is to say, an animal might learn to act a certain way when someone walks by to be, you know, potentially adopted. But what if, you know, that dog behind the scenes is maybe unhappy around other dogs, or, you know, isn't so good with children or other pets?
Right. Yeah, that's all a very good point. And I think the purpose of that sort of initial first impression is to make that first impression so somebody does want to spend the time to interact with the animal a little bit more, get to know them a little bit more, and see if it would be a good fit for their home. So we do encourage shelters to try to train behaviors that are appealing to most adopters. So I work with trainers that work specifically with shelter animals throughout the country. And some of the things that they like to teach dogs to do are to just sit whenever somebody's holding the leash, not on command. We always like to teach our dogs to sit on command, and they make a big point of this. Just when you're holding the leash, you automatically sit. And how impressive that would be to a complete stranger that walked up to look at this dog, and you hand them the leash, and the dog sits and looks up at you. You know, they're automatically making that connection and want to learn more about that animal. And so we try to teach little tricks like that that are real simple to do in the shelter setting, that aren't specific to any one individual, that just this dog can generalize to whoever's holding the leash or whoever's walking by, so that they do have a chance to get a closer look.
That's brilliant, and still very, very simple. Another thing that I should probably mention, and here I'll give praise to the organizations that foster animals, because there are many organizations around for different animal species too. I mean, there's people that help save rabbits. There's people that help save basset hounds specifically, for instance. So these organizations do amazing work because they will take animals sometimes from municipal shelters, and they will place them in homes where people can interact with these animals for a while. Those people either may end up adopting the animal themselves or help someone else know more about the personality of that animal. And that really could make a difference when you're looking to adopt an animal and you want to know a little bit more. You could go to the person who's been fostering the animal, and that person could say, yeah, well, you know, this dog has been great with my 3-year-old, and this dog, you know, there's another cat that lives in the house, and everything's really great, and this is a good pet.
Right. Yeah, that's a really important opportunity to learn more about that animal. That's the best environment, you know, related to a shelter setting, where we can learn what that animal's true personality is like, when we can report back to a foster home. And you mentioned, you know, sometimes they do get adopted by their foster homes as well. That's how I got my cat. We call those foster failures. And you wind up keeping the animal that you were fostering because you learned so much about it that you enjoyed working with that animal. So it's a win-win opportunity there. And the same goes for adoptions. I think something that I try to get across to shelter programs is, if you have an adoption that doesn't work out, you know, if somebody has to return that animal in a few days, you shouldn't look at that as a failure. Look at that as an opportunity to have free foster care for a few days, and now you can learn a little bit more about how that animal behaved in the home environment, so you can make the next placement a more successful one.
You're listening to Animal Airwaves. I'm Dana Hill, speaking with Dr. Brian DeGangi from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. Now, I mentioned off the bat that one of our topics today, our important topic today, is advantages of mobile technology in shelter medicine. Now, this seems somewhat vague, and we don't want it to be. So let's start, Dr. DeGangi, with kind of talking about, you know, our community specifically is fortunate enough to have plentiful resources, really, probably relative to some
right,
other communities,
sure,
even within our listening area. We've got this great big university. This university has a veterinary college, which in and of itself is not a very common thing throughout the country or throughout the South. What kind of resources does just that alone offer the community in terms of the shelter medicine?
Well, at the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine, we have tremendous shelter medicine program, probably one of the largest ones in the country when you look at all the different aspects of our program here. And we've been on before and talked about the Veterinary Community Outreach Program, which is where I teach, and we provide spay and neuter services for almost all the rescue groups in the county, as well as some basic medical care for them as needed. And we do training of our vet students in spay neuter and pediatric spay neuter in particular. And there's another aspect to shelter medicine at UF, which is the Maddie Shelter Medicine Program, which have also been on Animal Airwaves to talk about their work as well. And so they have a more broader outreach, and they work with shelters across the country at a generally higher level. And they also do an online certificate training program for students and for veterinarians. So we've got this really comprehensive, large-scale program at UF that doesn't exist anywhere else in the country when you look at all the different aspects of it. So we're really lucky that we have all those resources here, a number of faculty members with specific expertise in shelter medicine and various topics within shelter medicine. We have strong research programs that come out. So looking at some of the questions that we've been talking about, we can do studies and try to answer those questions in a scientific manner, and as well as all the training that we're able to provide with our students so that when they graduate and go out, they can do these things in their communities as well.
Mm. So tell me about then this mobile initiative, right, to help communities deal with animals in a shelter setting.
Yeah, so we're really excited about this program that we're going to be starting hopefully this fall, and this is going to be a component of the Veterinary Community Outreach Program. And so we have our stationary clinic at the College of Veterinary Medicine where we perform spay-neuter. But the idea behind the mobile unit is that we're going to be able to take this custom trailer out to shelters that aren't able to bring their animals to us for surgery. And so we can bring our services to them, ideally, hopefully, for free, depending on our grant funding. And they can, those animals and those shelters can get the care that they need.
It's an obviously great idea. Everybody loves the bookmobile. It brings the library to you. If you're able to take the services to the communities, wow, what a relief it must be for these places that their resources are limited to begin with. And
exactly.
But that doesn't mean that they don't have the animals that need care. I mean, they certainly do.
Right, right. And they just don't have either the budget or the time or the expertise to address those needs. And so part of our goal is to really focus on those shelters that really have no medical budget and no other options for veterinary care so that we can be a resource for them to provide that.
We'll talk about some of the technology in just a moment, but let's talk kind of about for you guys. This isn't something that can happen for free. You might be able to make the services available free to these communities. How does this get paid for on your end? Because it probably is not the cheapest thing to do to develop the means to take this technology out in the field.
Right. So we were very lucky to receive a grant from PetSmart Charities to fund the initial purchase and construction of our mobile trailer. So it's actually in its final stages of construction now. We don't yet have it. But we were able to custom design that with grant money provided by PetSmart Charities. So that's kind of gotten the ball rolling. And then we're looking to the college for additional support. We're just going to continue writing grants and doing fundraising, seeking donations as we've always done to sustain our program. So we're hopeful that we can, as we got the ball rolling with this large grant, we can continue to get other grants and get other people on board to help support this effort. Because, as you mentioned, this is mobile spay-neuter services is one of the most expensive models of delivering spay-neuter services, but it does reach a key target area that we're trying to focus on.
Mm-hmm. At some point, or perhaps already, are you soliciting help from the public?
We have not as of yet. Right now, we're working off of our grant funds, but certainly anybody can make donations to the College of Vet Med and all its programs by contacting the development office there. And there's lots of great programs that can benefit from the public's input.
Let's talk about the trailer. This is fascinating to me. What does a mobile like veterinary clinic need to have on board?
So it's essentially a small hospital on wheels. In our particular unit, we've got two surgical tables that are in there, so we can have two procedures going on at once. We've also got two preparation tables, so where we're going to be anesthetizing the animals and doing short procedures and getting them ready for a spay procedure or something that might take a little bit longer, be a little bit more involved. That could also be used as examination room. So if we don't want to do surgery one day, we want to provide medical examinations, we can use it for that purpose as well. We've got a bank of cages in the, inside the trailer itself as well. I think there's about 9 or 10 cages in there. We didn't elect to put more cages in there because the purpose of our unit is to provide spay-neuter services at local shelters. So these are places that are going to have housing units already available. And so we were able to fit additional surgical table, more room for supplies and equipment in there by taking some of the cages out.
But the trailer itself, I'm trying to imagine what it might look like. Is this something that obviously it must be towed by another vehicle or drives itself? And it's got to be big enough for people to move around in.
Right, yeah. So it's actually a 32-foot trailer that's going to be towed by another vehicle. And it'll be tight quarters in there, but there'll be everything that we need to provide safe spay-neuter services.
Mm-hmm. Multiple veterinarians will probably work in there at the same time.
Well, veterinary students and veterinarians. So the kind of plan for us us to operate our unit is to have one of our faculty members there, and along with 3 veterinary students and 1 veterinary technician, so that we can kind of fit everybody in there and be as efficient as possible without sort of overcrowding the space that we have.
You'll probably have on hand the kind of supplies that would be in any kind of stationary clinic, right?
Exactly. Yep. All the surgical equipment that you need, all the anesthetic equipment, something that we'll have on our unit that may not necessarily be in a stationary clinic is oxygen generator. So that saves a lot of space. So you don't have to have oxygen tanks around. You can generate your own concentrated oxygen just off of the air. So a little unit that plugs in and can generate enough oxygen to perform surgery.
Oh, that's amazing. Is that new technology or has that been around a while?
They've been around for a while. They just have real specific uses that they're for mobile uses like this. And in some cases, I've seen a few stationary clinics that use them as well, and it was a cost-saving measure for certain clinics.
Now, mobile anesthesia is kind of an interesting and specialized thing. This kind of equipment is probably not cheap. I imagine that something as specialized as that comes with a pretty hefty price tag. And so it's great that you're able to get grant funding. The funding, it seems to me, will help you guys kind of like put this together at the beginning. And then moving forward, the financial resources you would need would probably be just a more like maintenance kind of level.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, the biggest expense is getting the unit itself and having it designed to meet our needs. And so, again, we were fortunate enough to have a grant that covered all that. And so our next sort of challenge is to figure out how we can maintain it and keep it going. And, you know, we're hopeful that once we get started, people will see the work that we're doing and it'll kind of generate its own income in that way.
Mm-hmm. Now, if spay and neuter is the primary kind of goal here, but you can also take a look at the animals, any shelter will have a need for examination of these animals that come in. I mean, you got to know how healthy they are and whether or not they're suitable to even be put up for adoption initially. And veterinarians probably sometimes visit many of these shelters. When you're talking about doing spay and neuter in a mobile setting, how much space does that really take, right? Is that we've talked many times before on this program about spaying and neutering, but I sort of don't necessarily even know a lot what it looks like and how much space you need and how many people you need and what tools you need.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it really depends on the environment that you're in, what else is available. So I think one thing that we're good at in shelter medicine is sort of adapting to our environment. And, we're very commonly doing examinations in a room that's not meant for examinations. It could be a bathroom or it could be, a tent in a parking lot somewhere. And so you don't need a whole lot of space to do most of these things. I think for us, for spay-neuter, it comes down to equipment and making sure, you have the equipment that you need to do it. And that's sort of the biggest limiting factor when you're trying to do surgical procedures. But if you're just doing physical examinations and basic medical treatments, many practitioners work out of their vehicle and provide mobile services just out of their own vehicle, personal vehicle that's got the equipment and supplies that they commonly use and can cart around with them. And you can sort of limit your services based on what you can carry.
You're listening to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT-FM. I'm Dana Hill, and I'm speaking today with Dr. Brian DeGangi from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. We're talking about advantages of mobile technology in shelter medicine. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFTFM, our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill speaking with Dr. Brian Naganji from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine about advantages of mobile technology in shelter medicine. Now, we've been talking about a new initiative underway at the UF College of Vet Med to take a mobile unit out to communities that perhaps don't have sufficient resources to be able to do many of the medical procedures that animals in a shelter might need. But with this new mobile technology, veterinarians and veterinary students can come in and do things like spay, neuter, and really assist these shelters to do their core mission, which is to get animals into homes. When we left off, Dr. Brian Naganji, we'd been talking about some of the great technology that's on the vehicle itself that will go out to these communities. And I started to wonder, well, you know, this is really brilliant. And I can imagine that in some places, these sorts of things exist in a limited way in human medicine. You know, let's say there's an emergency and, you know, organizations like the Red Cross can come out and offer, you know, first aid, mobile first aid, that kind of thing. Where, though, did the idea for this for animals come from? Has this been around or who thought this up?
Yeah, this mobile spay-neuter services have been around for a while. And because they primarily serve a particular role in providing spay-neuter in the community, so like we alluded to before, we can bring these services to somewhere where it's otherwise not accessible versus a stationary clinic, which most of us are probably used to. The animals have to come in to one fixed location. There's a hospital set up there. There's a physical location where people can bring their animals and call if they have questions or complications. That doesn't necessarily exist with the mobile unit. So, but we can bring the unit out to real specific locations. And so people have been doing this for a while in different capacities. So you'll see a lot of vehicles where they're a little smaller scale, maybe one operating table. They're built into a unit in an RV type unit themselves versus one that is towable. So there are other mobile spay-neuter units in the state of Florida, but as far as I know, this is the only program that is going to actually target shelters specifically. Usually they're targeted particular areas of the public or locations in town, and not necessarily shelters themselves. So I think that makes us a little bit unique. I know of there's a program at Mississippi State University Veterinary School that is very similar to this, and they've been doing this type of program for years now, and they've got two or three mobile units that they take out to all their rural shelters to provide these services. So we're sort of working with those colleagues and modeling our program a little bit after theirs.
What was the alternative before this kind of technology and this sort of initiative existed? Would community shelters that needed spay-neuter services just have to kind of like, I don't know, once a week kind of round up the animals that needed to go and drive them somewhere to get this done?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we'll see a variety of sort of responses to that. And so, yeah, some shelters are able to, you know, find a set day and they can bring all their animals to one location, or all those that are waiting for a spay neuter. The particular shelters that we're targeting, they tend to have one, maybe two employees total in the shelter. So if that's going to happen, they need to get a volunteer to come bring the animals in. And indeed, that's some of the shelters that we do actually work with currently in our stationary facility. And it's just a real burden for them to find a volunteer that can transport a large number of animals to us, come pick them up at the end of the day when their procedures are done, bring them back to the shelter. And so that's one option. Other shelters, they may adopt animals out before they're spayed or neutered, which of course we don't like to see. In Florida, there's a legal requirement for them to be spayed or neutered, or to provide a voucher for an adopter to promise that they're going to get that service completed. Mm-hmm. But what we see across the country is that in wherever these voucher programs are used, there's not a whole lot of compliance with them. Once you know, people have the animal home, it's not real a priority to them to get the animal spayed or neutered. So we always try to encourage shelters to get them spayed or neutered before that actually happens. And then you'll see other shelters where they just adopt them out without being spayed or neutered. And so that may be better than the alternative. But certainly we don't like to see that either. And so it kind of depends on the individual organization, how they might handle it if they don't have access to spay and neuter services. I guess one other option is, and some of our shelters do this, is they bring their animals sort of one at a time as they can afford it to local private practitioners who will do the procedures for them.
Mm. What has been the student involvement in this initiative so far, and what will it be going forward?
Yeah, so there were, you know, back a couple years ago when this idea first came to us, there were some students that had talked about it and were supportive of it, and they had seen these programs at other universities, and they also recognized that this was probably the only model of spay-neuter clinic that we don't have access to at University of Florida currently. So something I'm excited about is being able to bring this additional model to our training program at UF so students can get exposed to it right here in their school. So they were supportive of the idea, encouraged us to do it, and moving forward, they obviously are going to play a huge role in running the mobile clinic. So we're going to have students with us. It's a clinical rotation that they'll be able to come on board and do the procedures under faculty supervision and take care of the animals. And again, just get to go out to these shelters, kind of understand the situation that these facilities are in, so that when they graduate, they can go out into wherever they're practicing and be an asset to the shelters in their community.
Now, students have already... many students will have participated in something like one of the big monthly or, you know, several times per year, these clinics in which lots of animals come in and get spayed or neutered at once. Some of the students will have even participated in a previous episode of the show talked about a program in which students go to South America, go to local communities sort of remotely. In some communities that are rural or maybe where it's not as easy for people to take their animals to get veterinary care, do some procedures there out in the field. And that's a great thing to be able to do, not only for the communities, but for the students to get that experience. And certainly students in the shelter medicine program will have probably been to various shelters in the community, maybe certainly in Gainesville or Alachua County, but maybe in some of the surrounding counties as well. This, though, is probably an even better way for students in this program of shelter medicine to connect with the communities that need this, because let's say you're doing this let's say you're studying shelter medicine and you're going to be working in a big city or something. Your experience there in a big city will probably be benefited if you could have seen another aspect of shelter medicine. Right, like if you could have seen what shelter medicine is like in a rural community.
Yeah, that's a great point, and I think that's another goal of this program is to just expose students to something they may not have seen before, and may not have realized some sort of the dire situation some of these shelters are in. Right in our own backyard. You know, we live in a very affluent part of town, and we have a lot of resources available to us, but that's not the case everywhere, even in just some of the surrounding counties. So it's real important that to me that students get exposed to a variety of types of veterinary medicine in general, not even just shelter medicine, but realizing that there are different resources available in different situations around the world, really. So I'm glad that we can expose them to yet another one of these through this program.
We live in a community that not only has a great big university, not only has, 100,000 people or more, but, given all that, there are veterinarians' offices like in almost every neighborhood around town. I mean, there are plenty of veterinarians in our community, but that is probably not true throughout the United States. Big cities, yes. Suburbs, yes. But there are certainly places that you can go, within, 50-mile radius of Gainesville, and getting to a veterinarian's office may not be easy for everybody.
Right. Yeah. Particularly in the rural areas of the country, that it can be a real issue. And so, in fact, it's something that we're talking about profession-wide is how do we get more veterinarians to go into those areas of need? They often are areas that have both small and large animal components to them. So like sort of a mixed animal, veterinarians are needed to work in those areas. Because there's just so many, there's so many areas where there's not veterinary services available. And so it's throughout our country as well, which I think we often think of that being a third world country problem or somewhere, just somewhere else, not here. But certainly throughout our country, we have the same issues.
And this exists in human medicine as well. I mean, the problem of how to get doctors to practice medicine in rural areas is a significant one. I mean, everybody, you know, who's, you know, not everybody, but certainly many people who are young and who are professional, who have, you know, gotten their degree in medicine, be it human or veterinary, well, you think you want to go to a city or you want to go to somewhere that has the kind of things that you want when you're a young person and you're kind of like starting out in your career. And, you know, if we're lucky, we're talking about some folks who maybe grew up in a rural setting and have decided to take on something like large animal, and you know they can go and they can work with horses or cattle or what have you. And you know maybe those people also have you know an interest in dogs and cats, as we kind of all do. But do you feel like there are insufficient numbers even now of young veterinarians going to these otherwise underserved communities?
That's a tough question. I think it's an issue that's sort of being debated profession-wide now as well, because we're seeing more and more veterinary students come into each class across the country and veterinary schools across the country. And so there's this discussion of, do we need more veterinarians or do we need to distribute them more? Or what, you know, what is the problem that is you know, causing this mismatch here? And I think you actually brought up an interesting point about the human health conditions as well. And something that we're also seeing is these areas that don't have access to veterinary care also don't have access to human care. And we're seeing people that are starting to do studies to track sort of disease rates and easily preventable disease problems. And there seems to be a link between locations that the humans have poor medical care and have been commonly preventable diseases, and animals having similar issues in those regions, and animals being more likely to be relinquished to shelters in those regions too.
Yeah, I mean, we all kind of probably understand that many of these communities are not as well off just as those of us. I mean, certainly every community, cities too, have issues of poverty. That's no secret. But you know, rural communities, in addition to just the remoteness of some of them and their distance from many of the resources that we take for granted in our communities, you know, when you're poor in some of these remoter places, life can be even that much harder. And so if it's hard for you to take care of yourself, you can only imagine that it's hard to take care of an animal, your pet.
Right.
What kind of solutions or proposed solutions are out there for solving the problem of veterinary care in more rural settings?
I think access is a key issue, and so that's something that this mobile unit can help in a small way in our region. But finding ways to deliver quality veterinary care to those areas. So maybe it's a mobile unit, maybe it's what we call a MASH style operation, where human or veterinary workers can go and they bring all their supplies with them and set up a unit, a stationary unit temporarily, and then take it down and move on to the next location. So figuring out where those sort of hot spots are, and then figuring out what do we need to bring to that area and how can we bring those services there. And that's some of the things that people are looking at.
Yeah. Long term, I certainly am probably not thinking of anything that someone else hasn't thought of before, but you know, maybe attracting more young people, students who are from these communities to begin with it, you know, if they enter a veterinary college, get a degree, it's possible that they may choose to go back to the communities that they've called home,
right,
and be able to provide those services. But obviously, as we're talking about today, the mobile technology offers a really great opportunity to maybe fill in some of the gaps. How long might the mobile unit go out to a particular community? and be in one place? Is it generally just a day at a time?
Yeah, I think our initial plan is to keep it fairly local. And so we would go out for the day and return back. So, you know, probably within an hour driving radius or so. And, you know, who knows, as the program grows and as we can expand it, maybe we can encompass more than that. But there certainly are a lot of organizations in need kind of just within that radius. So we're going to start slow and kind of get our feet wet and see how the unit operates and make sure we're comfortable with it and kind of expand from there.
The hope would be that as you move about and go to the communities that you are able to serve, that other organizations will be able to serve the institutions in the areas that you're not reaching, because certainly, you know, within an hour's radius of Gainesville, there are communities that could use the help, but there are also communities beyond an hour's time drive from here that could use the help as well. And one hopes that those communities could also find this kind of assistance.
Right. Yeah. Hopefully we can sort of lead by example and showing how we're successful with our program, and other people will want to replicate it in that way. And I think it's also important to make sure that you have a specific goal and specific mission in mind and really stick to that to show that you're effective. And so that's another one of the reasons that we're really kind of targeted on shelters that don't have access to veterinary care, that are in this confined area. So we really want to focus on that mission and make sure we can do that really well before we try to expand ourselves. But, you know, if we can be successful at it, just like we're replicating the program that other people have been successful with, we would love for people to see our success and try to do the same thing in their communities.
Well, let's talk about this in the short time that we have left. In communities where this has existed for a little while, have there been quantifiable benefits?
Yeah, so that's something that certainly we're going to look at as we start, is to keep track of anything measurable that we can measure in the communities that we're targeting. Most commonly, because of the nature of the shelters that we're targeting, there's not a whole lot of real good data that we can use. But most commonly, what you see is these organizations are tracking shelter intake numbers, how many animals come in and how many animals leave alive and how many, you know, how many leave by adoption versus in shelter euthanasia versus another method. And so what we generally see and what we hope to see is obviously more and more animals getting adopted, more and more animals getting adopted, having been spayed and neutered before they get adopted. And over the long term, fewer animals actually coming into the shelter.
Right. And of course, that's a function of spay and neuter in a substantial way, right? If the animals leave and they have been spayed or neutered, that's, you know, potentially a reduction in future intake.
Right, and that's kind of what we're banking on. And we've seen that happen, particularly in the northeastern part of the United States. They have historically had a lot of spay-neuter programs of all different types and have made spay-neuter access a really key priority. And like I mentioned earlier, it's hard to find puppies and kittens in shelters in the Northeast. In fact, we tend to transport a lot of our puppies and kittens from the South up to shelters in the North because there's such a high demand for them up there.
Mm. And as, you know, communities even like our own here in Gainesville are increasingly able to have shelters in which no animal is really euthanized that is potentially adoptable. It's possible that in the future we might even be able to see something like that move to the more remote communities in the country.
Exactly. Yeah, I think we will. We'll sort of see it trickle out from these larger cities, from regions of the country that have got it down. Now they're trickling to larger cities and resource-rich locations in areas like ours in the Southeast. And then hopefully it'll kind of reach out as our shelters get a handle on things and they can reach out themselves to the neighboring organizations and help them as well. And so it should hopefully benefit everybody.
It sounds like an absolutely great program. I look forward to hearing about it as it really gets off the ground and moves forward. Brian DeGangi, thank you so much for coming back and talking to us.
Thank you so much, Dana.
I want to say thank you to Sarah Carey and her people at UF VetMed and Glenn Richards for directing the show. I'm Dana Hill. See you again next week.